You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to the Orthodox Nationalist. This is a series of lectures that have been going on and on and on since 2009, dealing with every aspect of the Russian Orthodox tradition or history seen from the Russian Orthodox point of view. I, of course, am Matthew Raphael Johnson. This is being recorded the evening of the 25th of January 2025. Some time ago, a listener asked about the canonization of the postmodern patron, the Nun Maria Sklopstova, by the Patriarch of Constantinople and a whole bunch of Protestant and Anglican groups not that long ago. And I kind of put her out of my mind. As far as I know, she is not in the Russian calendar, but she is in the calendar at Constantinople, but she's also in the calendar of Rome and Canterbury as well. So she was a renovationist, someone who took upon herself the right to speak of very serious historical and spiritual topics. And allegedly, I mean, the only reason she was canonized was that she went to Ravensbrück, concentration camp, as a member of the French resistance. And the story goes that she was gassed there, which of course is absurd. And she was gassed because she traded places with somebody, you know, putting on her clothes or something ridiculous like that. Of course, it's an invention. So she was part of this renovationist movement. The only reason she was canonized again is because I guess the left was so sick and tired of the new martyrs, the Bolsheviks. They had to have some saint connected to National Socialism, but they couldn't have come up with a worse person. Everything that the left does, the modernists do, is based on deceit. They're never clear or obvious about their point of view. And even in the Nun Maria's writings, it gets very vague. You know, I've read all her stuff at one time, or at least in Russian. I don't know what exists in English, but it gets very vague, and they use words equivocally. It's pretty normal standard procedure for them. But the renovationist, or the neo-renovationist movement, is a modernist group, both at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution and later on, especially in France. They're always claiming to return to the practice of the ancient church. They never give any citations for this. Their view of the ancient church is ahistorical. And it's your typical modernist laundry list of things. So, Nun Maria, born in 1891, she was a social revolutionary. She was a leftist. There's no evidence that she was a direct Bolshevik. But when she emigrated to France, she was married a couple times, and she took tonsure by the Metropolitan of Logius, but never lived as a monastic. The alleged claim is that she was arrested by the quote-unquote Gestapo for hiding Jewish children. I'm not sure how the Germans would know who was who. The resistance, of course, was heavily Jewish, so it's very easy to conflate the two. You know, we all know the Germans held northern France from 1940 to 1944. The resistance, working for Stalin, just an army of heavily Jewish leftists, Many of them were captured and sent to various camps to the east. And upon their return, they told the world about their treatment. They were considered terrorists, not enemy combatants. And early on, there was no mention of any gas chamber or any genocidal program, despite having every reason to invent it. Many of you know what I'm leading to here. Paul Rassigné, probably the most famous member of the resistance, an atheist and a communist, deported to Germany, arriving in Buchenwald in January of 1944. His number was 44364. He survived, although was badly damaged as a result. He became a history teacher in 1948, and he started to hear the increasingly exaggerated stories of what happened. And he began to reject it, especially when they were talking about places where he was. Either exaggerated or outright lies to spew hatred against the Germans. He stated very clearly the false picture of the German camps had been created. And his first book, Crossing the Line, was really more about the fact that the SS were not involved. It was mostly Jewish thugs who controlled the prisoners, and that's where all the any of the atrocities came from. The communists had taken over. Every infantryman needed to be at the front. Then he came out in 1950 with The Lie of Ulysses, a glance at the literature of concentration camp inmates. And he went after all of these ridiculous stories. No one has ever given a rational explanation of how a gas chamber could have operated, why in the hell they would use Zyklon B. And these were all contradictory, and he really started to get very upset by this. I mean, he was unimpeachable. He died of kidney disease in 1967, which came directly from his treatment in the camp. Of course, thanks to Allied terror bombing, especially from 43 to 45, this entire supply chain had collapsed. So I'm not sure how all of the massive amounts of supplies that they would need to carry out these slaughters could have ever gotten there or gotten out of there. And it was his work was directed against Raoul Hilberg. And Rassigné questioned how the technical feasibility of all of this kind of thing. So ultimately, her martyrdom is a myth. It's a story. She is not a saint. She's a leftist that was promoted solely to answer the anti-communist, especially the canonization of the new martyrs and the stress on the gulag. But she's part of something much bigger. I mean, clearly she was part of the leftist and hedonist mentality that comes from Alexander Golitsyn, who you've heard me speak of in the Bible Society and Tsar Alexander I, but what we call colloquially the Parisian Theology, the Institute of St. Sergius, connected to the YMCA and numerous organizations that Maria was a part of, created a very different kind of church in France. And they tend to disguise their writings. In their writings, they disguise themselves using very vague terms, but sometimes they don't. They say things like, monstrous assertions of past centuries when they're talking about a doctrine. Very ambiguous, very reluctant, and you can expand the influence of these ideas, assuming that you know the nature of the terms. It's a method of getting these kind of proud Orthodox intellectuals. And it's almost the Protestantism of the Eastern Rite. They definitely deny church tradition and doctrine, but they don't come out necessarily and say so. The Archdeacon Kuraev denied the Holy Fire, accused Patriarch Theophilus of falsification. But of course, without a whole lot of evidence. Rejection of miracles, everything that the Bolsheviks did once they took over. People like Metropolitan Anthony of Zorozh was, you know, very similar in this respect. You know, he, the feast days, you know, like, for example, the entry of the Mother of God to the temple, he denies entirely in his writings. And that it's this very condescending idea that the fathers took everything too literally, too roughly, celebrating things that didn't actually happen. But they're above all that, and they understand these things symbolically. And there was even a case when Metropolitan was, you know, gave some justification for abortion, which is beyond the pale as far as I'm concerned. And of course, this was also directed quite often against Orthodox anti-Semitism, which is a huge engine for this, as it always tends to be. Metropolitan Suzurov says, he quotes very approvingly of Nikolai Zirinov, that the entire tragedy of the church began with the ecumenical councils when they canonized those questions that should have been left open. This kind of thing is typical of the Parisian school, but it's not that often that they're that open about the whole thing. They're very hard on the monarchy, especially when you talk about St. Constantine or Justinian, Alexander Nevsky, many others. They're very Protestant in that sense. And they tend to take the same so-called scientific or materialist point of view, this post-Protestant agnostic point of view, by rendering these things in these very wispy symbols. You read Alexander Schmemann, Alexander Men, it's all over the place, debunking all of these myths like the Soviets did. In fact, the myths are what they're promoting. And of course, it dovetails perfectly with the regime, with the New World Order, the Great Reset, after 1990, and of course, a loathing of nationalism, except for Jewish nationalism, of course. And of course, all with this mythic appeal to an early Christianity. I remember when the Antiochians in America eliminated fasting from Pascha to the Ascension, or to Pentecost, and they claimed that there was a early Christian precedent for this. And I asked several people, intellectuals in that jurisdiction, I'm not going to mention them, they're friends of mine, to give me a citation, and I didn't get one. There was a lot of these groups going back even to the turn of the 20th century, the new religious consciousness at the St. Petersburg religious philosophical meetings under the patronage of Metropolitan Anthony, Vygotsky, and of course, Bishop Sergius, Strogorodsky, trying to connect this with the symbolists, with the intelligentsia that they focus so much on. St. John of Kronstadt had condemned them vehemently in his On the Old and New Path of Salvation. And Pope Anastasius closed some of these down. The so-called Silver Age, which did have some pretty brilliant people, were a part of this movement. You know, Berdyaev, Rozanov, Bulgakov, Eusebius. The group of 32 priests, 1905-1907, Petersburg clergy, the so-called Union of Church Revival. And this was the foundation for the Renovationist movement of the 1920s. And of course, you know, liberal westernization was everywhere. Antonin Granovsky, the former bishop, called himself the Russian Luther, Protestants of the Eastern Rite. Very similar to the Catholic modernists of the second half of the 19th century. Their strange interpretation of John Henry Newman. This eventually, after the revolution, in exile, created the St. Sergius Theological Institute in Paris. The Masonic organization, YMCA, provided the financial support for all of this. It opened in 1925. The YMCA chairman, Mr. Mott, was a Mason and one of the founders of the World Council of Churches. This was the man who was sent by Woodrow Wilson to Russia during the February Revolution as part of the group of Elihu Root, who was financing the revolutionaries. And these were the people, founder of the YMCA, who invested in the creation of this Luvjogian schism, the Synod Abroad. That's Metropolitan Eulogius, Gordievsky. And you had people like, again, Bulgakov, Zinkovsky, Berdyaev, that non-traditional orthodoxy. And this was the Paris school had a substantial influence on Russian migrants. There was a lot of the modernists come directly out of this. This was the institutional and functional center for a lot of this. Of course, World War II changed everything. And of course, they were able to point the finger at the Synod Abroad. And when all the myths about, you know, Hitler and Germany began to surface, say, in the 50s or 60s, especially when Israel, the Six-Day War, definitely by that time in the Middle East, they were promoting them. And the response was quite weak. And this was, you know, the origin of the Orthodox Church in America and the ecumenical movement and all this kind of thing. Russian student Christian movement came one of the branches of the YMCA, working in foreign Orthodox parishes. This was the cultural control of the emigration. Russia is always a threat to the regime. They always approach this Rockefellerite Protestant approach to religion, denying dogmatic differences or pretending they don't exist, trying to turn them into historical misunderstandings, or more commonly, the condescending point of view that these people were too ignorant. And the Nun Maria says this all the time in her writing. They simply didn't understand as much as she does this what global pan-Christianity is going to be. So Mother Maria Skoptsova was not a theologian. She was not a scholar. She was a poet of a sort. I guess she's most famous for the article Types of Religious Life. Former socialist revolutionary. And she was a part of this movement. Initially, the YMCA and the Orthodox community of Estonia, where she traveled with Zinkovsky. So this image of her in this concentration camp, based on this irrational hatred of the Jews, who of course had done nothing wrong and had nothing to do with the Bolshevik Revolution, but she was arrested for being a member of the resistance. Now, whether or not she was involved in actual military activities, we don't know. They use women all the time. The claim is that she didn't. Maybe she was too old. But she had the faith had absolutely nothing to do with her arrest whatsoever. This claim that she was forging identity papers for Jewish communists, that may be true. But most of the story is absolutely absurd. And again, that's the only reason she was canonized. But this entire movement had a pronounced Jewish theme. And it was this concentration camp nonsense that led to this scandalous canonization by Patriarch Bartholomew in 2004. No other church, as far as I know, has recognized her. But this is a victory of the Parisian ideology. The St. Sergius Institute gave aid and comfort to the other side of, you could be anti-communist and still be a leftist for a whole bunch of reasons. Many of them followed Trotsky and all these myths about Stalin being anti-Jewish, which is utter nonsense. But people like Alexander Mann, Gleb Yakunin, George Kochetkov, Alexander Borisov, Lapshin, Nikita Struve, who died in 2016. A lot of anti-Russian liberal rhetoric. The Russian Abroad Foundation and Library. And of course, they vehemently opposed the canonization of the royal family and were at war with the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia. Father George Kochetkov and the St. Philaret Institute, he created the so-called Transfiguration Brotherhoods. In Orthodoxy, especially in Ukraine, had brotherhoods. We don't need a new one. But even the creation of a parallel hierarchy, that these so-called brotherhoods, they've been on in many cities of the church, they are subordinate not to the bishop, but to Father George. And of course, these basically support your typical corporate-funded NGO, because they are corporate-funded NGOs. They supported, if you remember the Pussy Riot thing, the regime still calls them a band. They weren't. They were just feminists who were very well funded. They were supported by people like Zubov and Father Kureyev, Mitrofanov. And you see, that group, St. Philaret Institute, you have people like Uniate Jesuit Robert Taft, Ernest Suttner, retired Bishop Seraphim, something called the Interweave Community. It's a member of the Philaret Institute Board of Trustees. And these are all extremely ecumenical bodies. They support Kochetkov, especially with the Finnish Orthodox Church, which is an offshoot of Constantinople, which is fully westernized and semi-Lutheran, and now showing tolerance towards sodomites, largely because they're powerful. The Cretan Council, as many of you have know about, the interconfessional Christian community, Christian communities and movements together for Europe, held in Munich in 2016, was an aspect of all of this. And of course, that was connected with UNESCO, the Council of Europe, and the European Parliament. And today, this stuff is functioning to give a pseudo-Christian and pseudo-intellectual support for the migrant invasion of Germany. And somehow, these people are seen by the media, I mean, conveniently seen by the media as representatives of the entire church. They receive their blessings from, of course, Pope Francis, who is demon-possessed, and Bartholomew. And this just continues to give aid. You know, they always have plenty of money. But the interesting thing is that they never come straight out as a body and reject Orthodox doctrine formally. It's more of a reformatting of the Orthodox consciousness. Ideological sabotage, ideological guerrilla warfare. So, 2004, the Patriarch of Constantinople canonizes Maria Skoptsova. Again, based on the myth that in Ravensbrück, she voluntarily went to the gas chamber and took the place of someone else. There was a huge push prior, at least 10 years prior to that, from the Protestants, from the Anglicans, from every liberal, you know, WCC sort of circle around, to have her canonized. Of course, it didn't happen in Russia, but of course, they were successful in Constantinople. Her canonization, of course, is completely false. I don't even think she was righteous, let alone worthy of canonization. Also gives a certain legitimacy to the Eulogian schism. She was close to the ideology, more or less, of Berdyaev, just not without his depth. Reading her works, there's a lot of ambiguity. It's not awful, but you kind of have to know where she's going to know what she means, because it's absolutely not obvious. Trying to be non-traditional, redefining monasticism is a is a huge agenda. I mean, the same thing for, you know, Philip Saliba and the Antiochians. Because even Livogius himself, talking about the Nun Maria, saying that she did not get rid of either her leftist political sympathies or demagogic inclination to influence people in monasticism. The fact that he uses the word demagogic, you know, this is very dramatic and largely based on sophistry. It was an attack on the Russian Orthodox Church, of course. In a way, it was a way to justify the Eulogian schism of the 1930s and the seizure of Russian Orthodox properties at the time. Her contempt for the Synod abroad at the time was, you know, second to none. But it was the Parisian group, journals like Russian Thought, through the efforts of someone, Archpriest Sergei Gekel, the leader in the fight against so-called Christian anti-Semitism. And not just that, but the anti-Semitic potential of the gospel and liturgical texts in particular. And the ridiculous Orthodox community, which was connected with Kochetkov's brotherhood. But her canonization was about being the banner of the intelligentsia's struggle against the church structure and doctrine. She's well known in certain Orthodox circles, but the entire drive for her canonization really didn't come from Orthodox people. It was imposed on the church from the outside. At least according to hero monk Sergius Rybka, the bulk of the church population didn't accept it, because no one who was connected with the resistance, I mean, they normally were on the far left of the political spectrum. The resistance was taking orders from Stalin as much as humanly possible. I mean, ecumenism today, it's professed by the same intelligentsia that these people wanted to empower. And when you have a lot of neophytes in the Western world, you have to make sure that they don't become like me, who converted many years ago. The fact that it fits perfectly with the NGO pattern, manipulation and deceit, you know, the erasure of borders and a single world economy. But beyond that, the WCC mentality, if not that organization itself, this was the impetus for her canonization. As I've said before, this can be traced back at least to Golitsyn's Bible Society under Alexander I, when the Masons, the Freemasonic groups, which Golitsyn was a member of, began to really predominate among the Russian intellectual or nobles of Petersburg. They have this conception of the monasticism of the future. It's a pseudo-monasticism. Maria herself talked about Christ's truth is replaced by countless rules, traditions, and external rites. So Christ's truth on the one hand and rites on the other are opposed. Claiming that somehow that these ignorant people who they've made a fetish out of it. And again, she really is never in any position to write on these things. But coming out in favor of, you know, radical changes to the liturgy, really the abolition of monasticism, of course, they're not going to come out and say that. Although, you know, maybe Philip Saliba may have. But what they want to replace it with isn't clear at all. The brotherhoods of Kochetkov maybe is as close as we can get. Of course, you know, even Karl Marx refused to talk about what the society is going to replace capitalism going to look like. And there's very good reason for that. They do things like this. Like, Maria sometimes wouldn't attend liturgy on Sunday because it was more important for her, not all the time, but to go out to the market for food, feeding people, you know, whatever. But the point wasn't to contrast those things. It's saying, it's creating a precedent. It's ultimately saying that the services aren't essential. Not being a good social revolutionary is far more important. Of course, those two things aren't in opposition at all. nor have they ever been. But she took monastic vows. St. John Climacus said that the main work of a monastic is prayer, not those kind of works. It's a good thing to do that. But why is this being done during the liturgy? It's just to make a point and to infiltrate the subconscious, saying that we don't really have to do these things. Her conception of monasticism, and she wrote something on asceticism and a few other things, but it's nowhere close to traditional sense of the term. Didn't notice St. Ignatius Brunchaninov's. You know, she traveled, of course, always had money, spoke at various public and church events, collaborated with various newspapers, various articles, all of these kind of things. You know, this is why I could never have been a monk, for a whole bunch of reasons, not just that. But ultimately, this is some kind of creating this illusion that, well, the life of the world and the monk are not mutually opposed, when of course they exactly are. Now, social service. Now, some monastics do this, but it's always secondary. We have many other people. I mean, I've worked in homeless shelters in 3 states for my many, many sins. Now, if she were a laywoman, okay, that would be one thing. Her agenda would be incorrect. But she's doing damage to monasticism in the process and doing it on purpose. Now, the revival of monasticism, of course, she never really had followers. It was an ideological matter. And to put social service in the place of the spiritual life is to say that the spiritual life is secondary. The oasis of a monastery, of course, would be completely destroyed by this kind of mentality. Secular minds will never understand, and she certainly had a secular mind. All of her articles, she didn't write that much, but they're all about external matters, you know, social issues. Of course, I do the same thing, but I'm not a monastic. The attacks on the old bygone Russia, her social revolutionary background played a huge role in all of this. Of course, the old saw of condemning Peter the Great's synod, yeah, that's legitimate. I spent hours doing that. But that's not why they're attacking it. Not for the point of view the old believers made. She claims the revolution was a reaction to the synodal period. The church was paralyzed. Apparently she missed a lot, or she wanted to miss a lot. John of Kronstadt, Optina, Glinsk, Seraphim of Sarov, Theophan, Ignatius. These were somehow beneath her. And in her most famous paper on the types of spirituality and the types of religiosity, it's a much lower form. Talk about that here in a minute. She doesn't seem to grasp monasticism. She's all over the place. I read her on asceticism, and she's quoting St. Isaac of Syria, and I'm not sure he's saying what she thinks he's saying. So she quotes, when she's trying to define what asceticism is, she quotes Isaac of Syria, and she says, and I'm quoting her now, "Asceticism is a great simplicity of heart which is irrepressible in love and grows from it. The difficult path that Isaac of Syria speaks is hidden in the renunciation of this world," in quote, for the feat of acquiring God's peace and opening one's heart. Now, I want to quote her now at the beginning of that article in more depth. "Having received the recognition of the Byzantine emperors, Christianity dressed itself in brocade and fine linen, became effeminate, adapted to the pomp of the court, and flourished greatly in external manifestations. Christian artwork, the construction of cathedrals, iconostasis, stained glass, but at the same time it lost its strong and rigid backbone of the times of martyrdom, spread out in breadth, the detriment of depth. And if this depth had not existed, it would be difficult to say what empirical forms of Byzantine Orthodoxy would have taken, but this depth did exist, and was preserved in the desert in Sinai near Alexandria, under the very walls of Constantinople. There's a lot to unpack here, and every bit of it is irritating. Strict asceticism existed and was promoted within the Byzantine Empire. Nothing became effeminate, and especially in the first millennium, probably a majority of emperors were heretics and persecuted the church. It's a problem that the church, you know, had the resources now to build their cathedrals. It never lost its sense of martyrdom. If you remember, some years ago, I did something, a three-part lecture on the saints of Montenegro. That was, I mean, she would, if she ever heard of these people, she would condemn them. They were talking about, you know, slaughtering the infidels. You know, they were going to be wiped out. Great saints and kings talking like this. That's martyrdom. That's suffering. But to try to oppose the Sinai Desert with Byzantine Empire, the two things coexisted. But this comes from this extolling the role of the intelligentsia. The intelligentsia, the intellectuals, the Berdiaevs, are to be used against the bishops. She saw herself as this messiah-like monk intellectual. But that doesn't really make any difference as far as the spirit is concerned. She never really found, as I said, never found followers. Maybe students among the laity, but amongst the monks, there's no one, you know, following the feet of the nun Maria. Orthodox monasteries in Europe were quite different from what she wanted. Her life, which was not monastic whatsoever, despite her taking these vows, had no imitators. You know, when she came to Europe, eventually settling in France, she didn't have much of an audience for the old and the socialist revolutionary activity. That would be found in the Second World War, of course. She saw herself as applying that to the church. In her article on the emigration, she argued that the immigration really is a fragment of the church, and that what we're doing, and all these groups that we talked about before, we're going to pave the way for a reformation. And when the Bolsheviks are driven out, I mean, they had mixed views on the Bolsheviks, we will cultivate the new Russia here. All kinds of delirious prophecies, none of them came true. She did see herself as a messiah revolutionary, but vehemently opposed to the patristic traditional orthodoxy. The use of words, use of equivocation is extremely important. In her types of religious life, she had a very disdainful attitude towards, for example, the Church Slavonic language, Orthodox worship, Athos and Valam, which she pointed, you know, are bad things according to her. The old calendar. So canonizing this person. What confusion? This was the point. The point was to cause confusion. The point was to somehow canonize the French Resistance. But Maria, now they call her Mother Maria, but she was not a abbess of anything. So calling her mother, I'm not going to do that. But these delusions were canonized here. Now, the claim in her official vitae is that the Germans in France didn't shoot baptized Jews. So she was helping to produce baptismal certificates, fake ones, so that they could show the German authorities. You know, there's so many questions here. They talk about the Gestapo. The Gestapo was a fairly small and unarmed organization. Going after the resistance was, of course, a military operation. The Germans had no idea who was baptized and who wasn't, or who was Jewish and who wasn't. Chances are she was never in a gas chamber, but likely she died of typhus. Remember, when the so-called gas camps were taken by the Soviets. They created the Holocaust myth. And this was really the whole foundation of her canonization. Everything else was sort of window dressing. The one thing that she really didn't do as a monk was build her prayer life, her prayerful Podvig. And I'm sure she did it, but it just wasn't an important part of things. Trying to turn the church into a Menshevik spirituality is doomed to failure. But let me get a little bit more into these five types of piety when she wrote her types of religious life. And I don't know where she got these from. She doesn't justify it, but the five types are synodal, statutory or legal, aesthetic, ascetic, and hers, evangelical. That's the ideal for her. Everything else was a deviation. Again, I don't know why she landed or how she landed on these five. There's an archpriest, Valentin Asmus, who wrote on her in 1999 in Blagovatni Ogon, issue number 3. Let me quote him here, talking about these types. With the synodal type, everything is simple. Mother Maria, who gave her youth serving the people in the ranks of the Socialist Revolutionary Party, and therefore did not know church life at all before the revolution, though God gave her a meeting with the great servant of the church, Popadonestiev, in her childhood, repeats hackneyed platitudes about turning the church into an attribute of the great power Russian idea. This determines the entire structure of piety in the synodal period. It is just not clear how this church of bureaucrats could reveal to the world the great ascetics, the seraphims, John of Kronstadt, and the great host of new martyrs. The statutory, the legalist type. And of course, there's always a problem with legalism. But that's not what she's doing. She's playing on that conception. But the idea of these moral rules, or really rules at all, except, you know, not be a racist or whatever it is, she includes the fanatical champions of the Slavic language, the great monastics. I mean, she throws all the great monastics under this concept of statutory legalism. Let me quote her directly. We now have two citadels of such orthodoxy, traditional, statutory, patristic, and fatherly, Athos and Valam. The world of those detached from our vanity and sins, the world of faithful servants of Christ, knowledge of God and contemplation. What is this world of holiness suffering from now? How does it view the modern troubles that are tearing us apart? What most troubles these islands of the chosen ones, these heights of the Orthodox spirit? Before them, the most important, the most urgent, the most topical is the question of the new and the old style calendar. This rule following manifests itself here as slavery to the Sabbath. There is something threatening and ominous, the fact that it is precisely in Athos and Valam, the age-old centers of Orthodox spirituality, that a person can find an answer to only one question out of all those posed by life. This is a new idol, a new paganism. You could hear the caustic mentality here. We can get very harsh in challenging her because she used this kind of language. Frankly, she didn't understand it. Yeah, the calendar is one important issue. She's got to know that she's not telling the truth here. Either she doesn't understand it, or doesn't believe it, or somehow feels excluded from it. Archpriest Valentin does point out that she had very little experience with the church prior to going into the immigration. You know, when Maria was writing these denunciations, people like St. Silouan and Sofroni, Vasily, they lived in Russian monastery in Athos alone. But the condemnation of this kind of monasticism under this very vague heading of legal, statutory legalism is a central point here. Then, arbitrarily, she has the aesthetic, meaning the type focused on beauty. She clearly doesn't like the divine services. I don't know if they're too long. She didn't understand. She certainly didn't understand the symbolism. You know, the old Russian peasants did. She didn't. And here's what she said about that. The sweet chants, the whispering overflows of readings, incense, blissful languor and beauty will envelop the sorrowful face of Jesus in a cloud. Will silence cries, will make heads hang down, will make hope fall asleep. Some will be lulled for a time by this enveloping splendor. Others will leave it. And between the church and life, there will always remain a great abyss. It's easy for me to say that she's simply projecting her own experience and her own secularism onto these things. That somehow the love of beauty will exclude the ugliness of the world. Well, I want to say that she and the French Resistance and Stalin's followers were the ugliness of the world. The mythology of the Holocaust, the firebombing of German cities, the subsidy given to Stalin's gulag by the West for decades, Mao's mass slaughter, all of this coming from this mentality, that's the ugliness. And of course, again, she calls it idolatry. You see, the vague condemnations. There's not a footnote in anything she does. There's no claim to any knowledge whatsoever. But for someone who doesn't really know that well, someone who doesn't want to stand through long services, maybe this will have some kind of a... So I could be spiritual and not go to the long services. I could eat whatever I want. In her youth, she was quite sexually liberated. And don't you dare tell me that's not relevant here. But her denouncing of asceticism... That's the another aestheticism and asceticism. Just more refined egoism and adultery. She said, everything changed decisively from the moment of the February Revolution and the life of the church. These changes were sealed by the All Russian Church Council and the restoration of the Patriarchate. But no matter how strong these changes in historical existence of the church were, they, of course, could not immediately change the psychology of the people or alter the mood of their souls. That's why the immigration took with it to foreign countries the memory of the synodal period of the Russian church, its way of life, its clergy, its art, understanding, the patriotic cause. Even now we have that synodal type of piety predominating. It's easy to prove if you take into account that the whole special Yugoslav synod, of course, the Russian Orthodox Church abroad, of our church life, lives precisely by this ideology of fusion of church and state, observes the old traditions, does not want to notice the new conditions of life, and preaches Caesaropapism. Now she's not using vague language. The passions, of course, always exist. There's nothing new about any of it. The tradition, of course, the natural law, is able to address all of this. She just either doesn't know it or doesn't agree with it. Of course, February Revolution, she's talking about the social revolutionary. She's talking about Alexander Kerensky. It's the these condemnations. It's really hard to argue against them because there's nothing there. She's claiming to be able to get inside of people's heads. You know, she hates Konstantin Leontiev, distorting all of this. I mean, she's in no position to talk about any of this stuff. But that's what this Parisian school was all about. I have gone out of my way to go after the Petrine Synod and the things that it did. But the reasons for rejecting that between the two of us are going to be very different. Because she really loathes the old believers. Everything's an idol except her own ideology. The world has moved away from Christ, therefore so the church has to too. The dogmas, especially the moral dogmas, aren't relevant anymore. Without understanding that the world has moved away, has rejected this. How is that possibly an argument for demanding that the church do the same? the condescension, the vague wording, and yet still with brutal condemnations of things that she shows no understanding of. And it's very rare that you hear from her the sort of system that she wants. She's very vague about that. She was no anarchist. The truth is, she was barely able to contain her contempt for Moscow. It had nothing to do with the Petrine Synod. She would have loathed it if the Moscow system had continued, if the Kievan system had continued. She says things like, Moscow forged the Byzantine tradition into a fixed form, into a cult of the letter, a cult of tradition, into a repetitive rhythmic gesture, the wild boiling of the Byzantine genius to freeze the Byzantine heritage. Which is a very pompous way of saying, I don't agree with these things. I don't agree with monasticism. I don't believe in asceticism. I'm a socialist revolutionary, and the church should be going along with this. As far as I can see, she was a materialist. You couldn't come out and say that. But given her very checkered past, now I've been married twice. I am not pointing fingers, but she was a sexually liberated woman. Something tells me that those kind of rules, and those rules always came up with the St. Sergius Institute people all the time, played a role here. She did have she took a job with the Bolsheviks after October, the October Revolution, essentially the local version of Health and Human Services, which was vaguely connected with this, especially when you had the sexual revolution, which was imposed early on by the Bolsheviks. It eventually, it couldn't withstand. It almost destroyed the country, so they had to abandon it. But she had to have been a part of that, at least at some level. But her analysis is simplistic, it's condescending, and simply incorrect. This belief that anyone supporting the canons and the way of life is doing it out of habit, not intellectual assent, is absurd. Yeah, she says, as a way to balance it out, she tries to say that, there's some good things about this mentality, a sense of duty, a sense of obedience. Of course, she goes after hesychasm, talking about, this shows you how little she knew. The legalist priest, according to her, she knows a special technique of the art of bringing herself to certain spiritual states. You can teach how to breathe and what position the body should be during prayer, whether the legs should be in the cold or warm. But if we look at this phenomenon, then a strong dependence is not even on Christian religions of the East. It becomes undeniable. This is the whirling dervishes, Hinduism. She just resurrected old saws from Barlaam the Calabrian against hesychasm, as if this stuff is essential. It's not. She just doesn't want to do it, or she doesn't see the point. Her definition of asceticism ultimately meant nothing. Her asceticism is social service. But even there, I'm not sure what kind of social service she's talking about. I don't think anyone told her that Hitler eliminated unemployment and poverty in Germany by 1940. If the leftist does it, but they've never done anything like that before. And he patronized the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia, and Metropolitan Seraphim Liade, who was a part of all of this. But in no way is she going to talk about National Socialism. She's an internationalist. All of these groups were. They believed themselves to be superior to the ethno-nationalists. That's as ossified as anything else. Like globalist liberalism isn't now completely ossified and dogmatic. She was absolutely dogmatic, just about those kind of things. There is no spirituality here. This woman wasn't Orthodox at any level, nor was anything coming out of the St. Sergius mentality, the Avlogian mentality. even when I was in grad school, reading some of these people, Alexander Menten, it just, there was so much flowery verbiage that I started to get lost in it. Schmemann was notorious for this. Metaphor upon metaphor. And I'm starting to wonder, what is he talking about? He is not being straightforward. Is he hiding something? And of course, he was. I mean, he couldn't just come out and say it, as far as the church goes. Now, of course, they can. And that's the nature of the modernist churches. You know, again, I don't really believe in jurisdictions. That's not the church, but there's certainly a tendency in some more than others. But the evangelical ideal, which is as close as she comes to giving any kind of something that she wants, it's self-sacrifice for the revolutionary ideal. It's to, in the idiomatic, to Christify society, which of course really what she means is secularize it. It's not that Christ will then inhabit society as a whole when socialism takes over. That's not the issue. It's that the church will then be secularized and turned into a social service organization. But I'm telling you right now, they aren't going to serve people like me. She speaks like a Jewish leftist revolutionary in 1905. This has nothing to do with orthodoxy whatsoever. The leftist agenda has never produced anything. It's always been imposed at the barrel of a gun. You look at someone like Franco, Adolf Hitler, or General Park in South Korea, there you have poverty almost wiped out. In less than a generation. But that's not the social service she's talking about. So, canonizing her shows you the fraud, the lie of what's going on in Constantinople. This woman simply didn't have the knowledge or understanding, and it's almost tough to argue against her because she's not really making arguments to begin with. She's simply listing assertions. These five types of religiosity are arbitrary. I'm not sure where she gets this, except that she already had the conclusion in her mind and she's trying to justify it. But rules, especially moral rules, that's the problem. She opposes Christification, as she calls it, to churchification. The church has to go. Christ then ends up being this vague symbol for left revolution, including the sexual revolution and secularization of the church and women priests and abortion and all this stuff. The church has to go. Dogmas have to go, of course, except for hers, except for that of the revolutionaries. If there's anybody dogmatic, it's your Darwinist, it's your social revolutionary of any stripe. And trying to dress this garbage up in spiritual verbiage that frankly she didn't understand, and then getting canonized for it, that's life in the modern world, in the postmodern world. She is the patron of the surreal, of the postmodern hyper-reality. And orthodoxy suffers as a result. Thank you everyone for listening again, and I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.